Wisconsin, I'm the senator.
The year-round population of the city is around almost 1,500 in the summer for the, of course, all the lake area around in the city. It increases by about 10,000.
It seems like the prices of things goes up a lot on account of the tourists. The store paid more attention to the tourists than they did to us farmers. And we didn't like that because sometimes, you know, we come in and just wanted a piece of machinery in a hardware store or something, and there we had to stand and wait whether they were shoeing the wags with the tourists.
Trailer houses, campers, a lot of them come in that way now. Years ago, well, let's say 50 years ago maybe, it's just the wealthy ones come up. They would come up here and have their 2 to 3 weeks vacation, whatever they had. At that time, that livery team is what they call them, would haul them out to the resort, somewhere 25, 30 miles out. They would stay there until it was time for them to go back, and the team would go out and get them, bring them back to the depot. Now, of course, with the cars, they come and go as they please.
Gangsters, Indians, and Tourists is the last in a series of four programs about Hayward, Wisconsin, and the country surrounding it. Back in the 20s and 30s, not only the wealthy came to get away from the cities, but numerous public offenders also came to get away from the law and sought refuge in this dense pine country.
38. That's when I went in as a traffic officer, a county traffic officer. But about the time your cars were getting quite fixed in, and of course, as your cars come in, there was more problem all the time. Oh, I'd say in them days, a lot of family troubles probably, and drinking problems such as this. And of course, I've always have had the thievery that's been here as long as I can remember, breaking into cabins and stuff like this, especially in the wintertime. This was probably the trouble. We had murders. I was involved in, I think it was the late 30s. I picked up a fellow that set up a license plate that had been reported to me that morning as being stolen. And I started out in the country that afternoon and met the car with these stolen license plates on it. So I stopped him. And he and his wife, it was supposed to be his wife, it turned out that it wasn't. I got him into town. He drove his own car to town and the wife rode with me. And when we got into town, he turned around and took off. He finally jumped out of his car and took to the woods on foot. And we ran him, worked on him then for about a week, 10 days before we finally caught him. They finally killed him before we could catch him. They had him cornered one morning, and he killed two of our deputy sheriffs. One of them was standing right alongside of me, and he was so close to me that his blood just burnt my face. How we got wise to him, he broke out of jail. That actually broke out. He was a trapper, and they caught him violating the trapping laws. He had these traps still on his trap line, so he asked the sheriff to let him go out and pick up his traps so they wouldn't be killing any of the animals that spoil. And the sheriff, that was in McWanaga, Wisconsin, and the sheriff sent a deputy out with him. So he got up to this creek, and he told the deputy, he said, I've got a trap right on the other side of this creek. You can see me all the time. If you don't want to walk in the water, you can see me get over there and get it. But I got on the other side of the creek and took the woods.
Then we had a lot of others, like Joe Soros and Al Capone. I worked on all of them. He had a place out here at Barker Lake. That's, he even had guards. He got stone pillars there and lookouts. And he had a plane that flew in there. But I think they were on their record and from Canada for them. My parents wanted us shaving them. And I said, I wonder who that fellow is. I said, there's all somebody sits in the car when he's in here. And he laughed and he said, don't you know who that is? And I said, no. I said, that's Al Capone. And of course then it dawned on me because I'd seen the scar on his face when I worked on it. But I cut his wife's hair and he was all somebody at the car all the time. Oh, he talked, but he not, I don't know who he was, he never mentioned anything.
Al Capone and John Davis are from Harry Potter.
You go to Al Capone's house, and where?
Sorry, Georgia, Dakota.
Did you ever have any conversation with him?
Oh, sure, he did. He stopped by every time he came again. He was a very friendly guy. But he kind of ruined himself going. He found one deer and had 18 shots of machine gun. It cut the deer in half. And then said, practice not.
A live deer?
Yeah, a live deer. No. But he had his gun turrets, you know, for both of the machine gun around. Of course, he's damn guy would practice upon a deer and come right.
This fellow, Joe Saldis, he was they called him a beer baron in Chicago. He was at something like Al Capone. And he came up there, and he bought a big chunk of property right on Barker Lake. And he built a big golf course, which right now is operating. This was way back in the 20s, see. He had lots of money. And I worked there for a while, and there was a bunch of us kids went out there to work, and a lot of my dad worked there. A lot of older people got a job there, and it was, I turned out to the kind of money was pretty tough, you know, he had lots of it, you know, so he sure helped me. Oh, yeah, I knew him well, sure, yeah.
What do you mean?
Oh, great big man, and I always remember one thing about it. I was out, my dad had taken the job of, because he was going to put his own telephone line in. Because you see, in those days, the telephone company couldn't afford this. This was eight, 9 miles from where. I know my dad one time, and another man were working there, and they were staying right there in a cabin. And one time, a big car come up, and it was federal men, see. And they came in, and they were searching the whole place, looking for one of these guys that had killed somebody or something. They thought they'd heard that he was up here holding up, see.
Mm-hmm.
And they would come in this cabin, they searched the cabin where my dad and this other man was, and they had sawed-off shotguns and everything, see, looking for this guy. As a little, most of them were pretty good fellows. I liked most of the fellows. They were, might have been tough guys, but they were nice to see where they worked. Everybody ate in the same place. All these men come in there, except Saldis, he didn't come, but all these other fellows, these henchmen of his, they came in and ate right with the crew. Mm-hmm. And all these fellows, really nice guys.
What's the effect Prohibition had on this town?
None. This is much whiskey and moonshine stuff floating around here, and more than we were before, I think. I've run across a lot of stills laying out in the country now. And even now, I know there's several of them out there, you know, that's all the damage, of course, you know. But boy, I'm telling you, some of that powerful lightning there is that. I know I never took a drink in my life, but I did have to take one sip of that, and that was the end of that. I fell down the steps. Well, there was moonshine going on in those days, homebrew.
My grandfather was the Deputy United States Marshal for the Western District of Wisconsin during Prohibition days. And the Prohibition agents would go in and make the raids on the stills or the bootlegging operations. Minimum sentence at that time was 90 days in the House of Correction at Milwaukee. And then they were put on probation for a year. And that would hold for the first three times they were picked up. And the fourth time they went to Leavenworth. And Grandpa became very good friends of a lot of them because he transported them a number of times to a number of different places. Grandpa had a great big Buick touring car, and he put his prisoners or would-be prisoners in the back seat and drive to Ashland. They were not violent.
It seems to me Hayward relies on her natural resources for her livelihood, right?
Right. I remember as a child when the mill burned in 22, it was going out then, it was the last. But, oh yes, yeah, that was, Hayward had nothing but the resort in the farming industry at then when the mill went out. And, Well, yes, they were employed at the mill, and of course, when the mill burned was all gone, then they had to see, they sought employment in the resort business, carpenter work and things like that were the only thing left.
The The federal government established a transient camp out here during the Depression days for footloose and homeless men who had no other place to go. It was federally funded and administered by federal employees.
I built this Tobedic Dam. I was a superintendent on it. When we built that, with all the transient labor, we had a big transient camp out here where the Haiti Hospital is today. And they had hundreds of men in there. You know, as you mentioned, a lot of old bums find a place to sleep and eat for the state, built these places for them. And we used that labor. I had every class of people away, from dentists, doctors, lawyers, everybody else who just turned out to be bums. And 90% of them turned out that way from drink.
Depression days, 1930s, there were millions of those young people out of work. Even college graduates. And I think there was this hard on everybody. Even the farmers had to leave for their cows.
At the time, after the bill went out and the economy was just recreational, we had resorts. All they amounted to were fishing camps. And some of them are still operating. Of course, they've been renovated and they're modern. We had a group of young men in town at that time who were in business and wanted to see Hayward grow, and they organized themselves into a chamber of commerce, organized into associations, advertised, and that's how it developed.
I was shown away at the various summer all our clubs, like the Wismo Club.
A shore boy, did you say?
A shore boy, yeah.
What's that?
Well, it was pretty strong to feeding fish, I tell you, and taking care of the lawn and things like that, packing fish for shipping. Incidentally, at the Wismo Club, there was a J.M. Studebaker there. One of Walter Cronkite's relation had a cabin there also.
Weren't hard really summer homes at just these clubs.
So your dad was a guy?
He was a guy who built it, didn't go to the law board more than just to do building, and if they told, why, he ruled all this. Mm. And now and then you get some people who would cast, well, that was much easier. You just need a long slope, you know, around reed beds, and they'd cast well and things. Talk about fishing now. It always reminds me of the story that there was only one meat market in town, and then we had a gold beaker on it. And he went in there one day, and of course, this beaker had never seen him before, and he knew just about it was around this area, and he recognized and streamed it. So he asked him if he was located around here somewhere, and my dad said, yes, I just bought a piece of land out here on Cooley Lake. And the beaver said, oh, Cooley Lake, oh, yes, I know that lake well. He said, it used to be an awful big muskie lake. He said, we used to go out there every Sunday and get 18, 20 muskies every Sunday. But he said, it's fished out now. You go out there and fish all day, you only get 3 or 4 muskies. It quit going, you know, because that wasn't.
Well, there used to be a higher class of people come here. They don't come here, they only go further north. You see, the guy that's got the money, they go further north. And the guy that don't have so much, stop here. You know, we used to guide people that were remote, like...
You were a guide?
Yes, in the 20s. He used to guide people like John Deere and Alaska Juniors and Randall Chamberlains and all that stuff. I can't name them all, but there used to be that type come here, see? You don't see them no more.
Did you have pretty good success, though?
All the time. You could catch fish anytime you went out of there. You could just about bet on it. In fact, on Peterson's bar, I'd go and give him a whiskey. On no pay.
Is it your brother who told me about Spoon Hook Lake?
Spoon Hook Lake, yeah.
He told me about the bass jumping up and after the spoon hook.
Yeah.
Now, that was a pretty good story. I like that.
Well, that was me that was out there. I was going to violate. That's before our game warden, of course. I was going to ride a little bit to the lake. I was down there at Hutton Shade in the lake on the Barrett Hill there. And so we saw a lot of sheep catching deer there coming to that lake. So they made quite a few deer run, and I had got a new fish rod. That's before I started to guide. And I think there were 19 somewhere. And I got this tackle and I was going to climb out on a log, and I threw a hook out there, and I got my drill and in there. Well, one bass had to hold the hook, and another one's alongside of the waiting for his chance. Well, thank God, I forgot about the deer hunting, so I sticked the limbs off and tag over the tree there and shoved the gills over there. And in the meantime, my hook dropped down the water alongside of the log. So I got it up, and my God, there wasn't that much running on the time of the dark. The right in and fish picked up that thing and out in the lake, and I got in too. So I had another guy who got 22, so we better get out of here, we can't kill him. Yeah. And never had nothing but just that one swivel.
I listen to fish stories more than I tell them. There were more big muskies caught in those days. I mean by that in the 30 to 40 pound class or larger. We might have 6, 8, or 10 of those a season, whereas now 1 or 2 a season is good. Our catcher at our lodge will run 100 to 125 muskies a season. And people used to seem to think that in the old days the muskies just jumped in the rope. You got them every day. Well, it wasn't that. I remember a week or 10 days at a time when nobody brought a muskie in.
I know we were in a hunting camp up at Ghost Lake, and the lady says to us, if you can get a muskie, she says, I'll fix it for you for Thanksgiving. And she sliced apples and wild rice and cranberries, and then she put a strip of bacon in it and baked it, and it was just delicious.
That's the best thing to use to catch a muskie.
Well, the best thing to do is get a good outfit, of course, good rod and reel, and then take a accepted lure that they might be hitting on at that time, either surface or bucktail or underwater lure, and start out early in the morning and fish hard all day long till dark.
Around
the weed beds in the shallows. They're primarily a shallow water feeder, but the only thing that gets a muskie is hard work, or else an awful lot of luck. This is our family's 56th year or season in the business here at Hayward. We started out with 3 cottages and part of the main lodge over there. It was a branch fishing camp for Cornix Resort, which was closer to Hayward on Spider Lake. So they had 3 cottages and a dining room and kitchen when we went there, and a bar and an ice house and so forth. And pretty crude accommodations in those days. And one of the interesting things compared to now is we might get the reservation in middle of May that they wanted to come up in June. And if we had 2 or 3 weeks, we went out and cut logs and built a cabin for them if we didn't have space. Because all you had to do was put up 4 walls and the floor, put some bedding in, and put the out back, and you were in business. Kerosene lamp.
What about the heating in those cabins?
Oh, pot-bellied stove. Good. Then we got to the point where, cabin by cabin, we installed electricity, and then went to a central shower and bathhouse, and then pretty soon we had to start putting baths in the cabins. And over the years, we've become a very modern luxury resort, so-called.
Well, the first thing is that you had men come fish, and then...
Yeah, but now we have a great many families and women, and over the years, we've had a lot of couples come as fishermen. I mean, real good, both of them fish hard, and women that like to fish.
We had a chance to buy this resort. We were men serving off of it. Although a person of the family that big, you've got to have a subsidy of some kind. You just can't make your year-round living off the short season we have in the resort business.
They say it's a depressed area, and we don't get no housing here. We haven't got that, and I can't figure it out.
Did everybody have jobs?
Most of the people have, yes.
When I came up here, I expected to find a place for the welfare state practically. Everybody on food stamps. From the way it sounded.
Yeah.
But that's not true.
No, there's not a lot of food stamps, but I don't think there's anybody suffering up around here. Trouble is, too many of them today don't want to work.
They don't do
unemployment?
Unemployment,
yes.
They're just working the salary in the resort area, earning that good resort money,
yeah,
and then going to...
Unemployment, winter time.
But you got the facilities you got here. Of course, there's a lot of work to get them up to where you can utilize them for a living. But right now, right now that I met with the counter, we're building big ski trails. Miles of it here. Of course, we had people from Europe and all over here last year for this winter industry. You think a lot of the people that come in here today are more or less working people that we are. They save their money for a 2 weeks vacation, a 10-day vacation, and that's when they come up to spend it. And they'll bring their families with them.
I don't know how you feel about this, and I'll ask you, is that when tourists come up here, they're probably saying, oh, there's an Indian, they would like to see Indians. And I mean, tell me how, first of all, how you feel about that attitude.
We got one like a call, can be an Indian. You got to come up and see them. We were surprised that we lived in houses a few years ago. Party stopped with them. They were looking for teepees. They were from New York. They never heard about Indians, how they live nowadays.
But how do people, your friends, really react to that kind of, you know, tourism?
It's stupid.
It's
For my part, I don't resent it, and I don't go for it. Mm. But I just take it as it comes.
I have one Indian woman working for me now, and I've had a number of them. This woman is our third or fourth year that she's worked for us.
That resorts are on chiefly, they have Indian women work. Like cleaning cabins. I used to do that.
I worked at Williams Resort for about 3 years. I was a head cook there, cook for the tourists. I used to fry fish for them.
Their own fish?
Yeah, their own fish. And the woman I cooked with, I was the one that fried fish all the time. And she'd take it in the dining room, but I think she got paid for frying fish. I didn't get anything.
My father, he was a guide tourist, so he was a caretaker for 20 years. We built summer homes during the summer.
Oh, when came time to build these new houses in here, who built these?
A power company furnished the labor, I guess.
How do these homes compare with the homes that you had before?
Oh, the power company built one to build one in the winter. There was no insulation, there was no foundation. There was no basements. It was just more of a shacks, you know. We have this housing program on the reservation where we build these new homes, what you see on the road. I think there's only two houses left that the power company built.
Did all folks, there was an established village there?
Yes.
And what happened to it?
Well, the power company came in and flooded all the area. So they had people had to move. The people didn't want to dare to be built on the river, and all the lands condemned. It was 76,000 acres at one time. Some people didn't move at all, and then until the water came up, they had to move. The power company built these shacks up here for the people. They moved all the rice beds on the river. Everybody had their own rice beds, took care of the river. You see them every year.
And what are some of your problems that you're facing right now?
Our resources are cutting out. Fish and game, wild rice, berries. So we're trying to, what we call the boundaries of the reservation, trying to preserve our game. And there's too many tourists taking our game out, you know. And we don't have anything to say about it.
Wait a minute. You mean other people are allowed to come into your land?
Yes. Maybe they just stay at home.
The state claims the water.
The state claims the water? Is that the Chippewa?
Yeah, afford it.
But you still have all the rights that you need, don't you, to fish there?
Yeah, we still have them rights.
There's a rule for people.
What?
When there's so many boats out there, you know. Indian people don't have any.
I see that people are infringing on some of your rights.
Oh, sure.
And you feel that they should be exclusively yours.
Yeah.
But the resort people do not. And resort the other on account of these fishing rights. But they try to keep people away from fishing all that. Well, they're going to have a meeting now, I think, Wednesday. See, they brought up another law that no hunting, no trapping, or hunting, you know, from there. Yeah.
Or maybe they can't hunt there, then you can't
yeah.
come home.
Well, we can't hunt there, but it's outside of the business now. That's against the law.
If you have a license or...
Oh yeah, we have a license, yeah. Mm-hmm. As you know, we live close to a big reservation, and the Indian can hunt on that reservation any fish anytime he wants to. But a lot of them don't seem to know where the lines are. And of course it goes for the white man too. It's not only the Indian, but this is one of our troubles.
The Indians, they hunt all the way around, kill them. They hunt any way they want, but they have dogs, they have lights, anything.
But they complain about the supply now.
Yeah.
They complain that there aren't enough anymore.
Most of them don't know where they hunt. Why hunt when the government will give them all they want to eat?
I think they have to work out their own problems there.
You think it's a localized problem?
I think more, yeah.
There has been quite a big discrimination from here with outlying districts too.
I don't know why.
I don't know, you know, the more version of our people that were lazy and good for nothing, all that sort of stuff.
I had some very fine friends who lived on an Indian reservation, Indians. They're not all like most of the people in the county think they are. You know, there's just a few of them that are pushing, just a few of them, but the Jaguar Indian down there, he don't want none of this trouble at all. He's being pushed into it by somebody who wants to be on top. The white people, maybe just a little Indian blood in them, very little, and then trying to push the Indian ahead further than he wants to go.
How's the employment problem, as far as the rest of the people here are concerned, at the present time?
Well, the tribe is being funded by the government for different projects, so at this time there is plenty of work. Not plenty, but everybody seems to be on certain times a year. The forestry, working for forest land improvement, is what it is.
Gangsters, Indians, and Tourists concludes this series on the history of the Hayward area as told by the residents of the various communities. Produced at WHA Radio, a service of University of Wisconsin Extension, partial funding for the programs was provided by the American Revolution Bicentennial Commission and the Educational Communications Board. We are indebted to the Hayward Historical Society for their cooperation, and anyone interested in hearing tapes of the programs will find duplicates housed in the Carnegie Free Library of Hayward and the State Historical Archives in Madison.
Hi, Jim. Grandma and I recorded the session that preceded this little visit from me with the thought that you might be interested in it. It's Saturday afternoon, the last day of 1977. We're sitting here watching the snowfall. It's been snowing all day. And we do hope you'll enjoy this tape. And then you take the other side that's blank and fill it and send it back to us. Okay, Tim? Ruth, did you want to say hi, Tim? It's almost done here now.
Hi, Tim. Have a happy 1978. Be a good boy.
Happy New Year, Tim.